For those of you who don't know me, I'm Chris Holmes. I'm a lecturer in the department. It's my enormous pleasure to welcome Professor Stuart Eldon to talk at the PACE departmental seminar today. Stuart's Professor of Political Theory and Geography here. You can get a flavour of where his work sits and on the intellectual spectrum from that, I think. I think it's fair to say that the broad sweep of his work engages with a variety of areas in the tradition of political and philosophical thought, drawing out its spatial aspects, the geographical, but more importantly relating it to a variety of really interesting conceptual and practical problems in contemporary global politics. His work has attracted a string of prestigious awards, and just on Monday he was inducted as a fellow of the British Academy, which I heard was a day of meetings followed by ceremonies, so it sounded fun. and so today he will be talking on his new book, The Birth of Territory, which there's one copy here. You can see it's a substantial work, full of impressive insight, which I'm looking forward to hearing about. We'll have half an hour or thereabouts for Stuart to talk, and then half an hour for question and answer, which I will chair. And after that, there'll be some complimentary wine outside for you to enjoy. Thank you.
OK, thank you very much. It's very strange to talk about a book that's finished. I've always tried to talk about things that are still in progress because they're interesting for me to talk about, because I want to hear what people think about them and I'm willing to change things. This is kind of done. It's there. So it's a bit of a strange thing to talk about in that sense. I've been working on the question of territory for a long time, and three kind of main registers in which I've been thinking about territory. A set of contemporary political questions around territory, some more conceptual, philosophical, theoretical questions around territory and other political concepts, but particularly other geographical concepts. And then the project that I've been working on and off since 2000, when I was actually in this department the first time, I actually drafted some of the material that ended up in this book. And it was a book that I knew I wanted to write. I knew roughly what I wanted to do. But for various reasons, other things kind of took precedence, and I put it aside at different times to work on different kinds of questions. And one of them was this book, a book that came out in 2009, on territory in the War on Terror, but taking a slightly broader time period, looking particularly at what has been happening in the post-Cold War world. And one of the reasons that I wrote this book was that I felt that it was a good answer to a question that I always got whenever I talked about my historical work, which used to go something along the lines of, all this medieval stuff is all very well, but what does this have to do with anything that's going on today? And what that book tries to do is to show how the more kind of historical, conceptual way that I've been thinking about the question of territory helps us to understand some of the changes that were going on at the time that I was actually writing the book, which was in the sort of period 2005 to 2007. Having finished that, I then thought, right, okay, now I can go back into the archives, back into the historical work, and work on that question, because I've got the best answer that I can give to why this work is worthwhile in terms of our present. Now, one of the things that I tried to do in both that political work on territory, but also in this historical work on territory, is to say that we need to think about territory as a much more complicated concept than is generally acknowledged. People tend to think that there's a lot of complexities in terms of individual territories or individual border disputes or individual territorial arrangements, but they've tended not to think that the concept itself is one that has a lot of complications in it. Now, what I suggest is that actually territory is quite often collapsed into two other notions, both of which I think are really important, but seem to me to be insufficient to grasp the complexities of territory. One of those ways that people think about it is that territory is effectively a form of land. It's a political economic relation. We can understand territory through questions around property, in terms of rent that might be derived from this, in terms of the accumulation of large-scale territories through land accumulation, and that this is a way to understand it. I think it's absolutely important, but I don't think it's enough to understand what's going on in the notion of territory. The other one is what I'm calling the notion of terrain, a kind of political strategic way of thinking about things, of kind of power relations, of battle, of military geographies, these kinds of questions. Again, I think that's absolutely crucial, but it doesn't seem to me to get at the complexities around the idea of territory. So I suggested that there were at least two other registers, and these were the two that I privileged, but I'm sure you could add many more to this. Two other registers that were really important to get to grips with the complexities of the question of territory. The first one was to take the question of the law much more seriously than I thought was done in a lot of work in political geography and work on the question of territory. So if we think about different forms of legal power, authority, what we now call sovereignty, but historically was called supremacy or superiority, what did those things apply to? What was the area in which those legal codes operated, and where did those legal codes cease to operate? And it seems to me that there's an important moment in the history of political thought when territory, or the territorium, Latin word, becomes an object of political rule rather than simply the possession of somebody who is powerful. That seems to me to be an important moment when, instead of a city owning territories, a king accumulating territories, the area where the king's rule operated, the extent of an empire, the extent of a state's sovereignty, was within a territorially circumscribed area. It applied in that area and no other laws did, and it didn't apply outside of that area. That seems to me an important moment in the history of political thought. The second register, and this is in kind of broad terms, but this is what I tried to work through in much more detail historically, is what I've called the political technical or the technological, about how particular kinds of techniques based on changes in mathematics allowed states and kings, or states particularly, to survey, to control, to regulate, to order, to organise the things at their disposal, both their population but also their lands, or as I suggested, their territory. So about how cartography and land surveying are tools of statecraft, they're things used by states in order to extend their power over much larger areas than they were able to do before. And so it's weaving in these stories about kind of the technical, about the development of statistics, or what used to be called political arithmetic, alongside the cartography, the land surveying, the military technologies, and so on. So from that, what I suggest that is territory, it's not simply a political concept, it's not simply a geographical concept, there's a kind of a bundle of a number of different things going on, a number of different registers that we need to understand if we're to make sense of the question of territory. So territory then is something that has at least economic, strategic, legal, and technical ideas tangled up in what we think of as the political and geographical ways of thinking about that. Now, what I was trying to do with that was not to say, and that's a better definition of territory than the ones that are out there in the introductory political geography books or the introductory international relations books. What that was an attempt to do was to say, these are the kinds of registers in which we need to ask the questions in order to understand how territory has been understood and practiced in different times and places. So it's not an ahistorical definition, but it's an attempt to ask the kinds of questions that we need to in order to understand how it's been understood in these different contexts. And really that was the guide that took me through the historical texts, the material that I used in writing this book, The Birth of Territory. And for me, these two books then sit together. They're two parts of a broader project, one very contemporary, one very historical, but both of them trying to understand territory as something that's complicated as a concept as well as a practice, and thinking about the relation of those terms around there. Now, I said I began some of the work in 2000, 2001, and finally finished the book in 2012. I got fortunate, and I had a Leverhulme Major Research Fellowship, which brought me out of teaching and administration for 3 whole years, and I used every minute of that time, along with a lot of other time, to write the book. But what that award gave me was the kind of ability to say I'm not going to make any compromises in how I do this book, that I'm not going to make any of the shortcuts that I might have had to do had I been under other pressures and so on. So it made me able to go back. What I made as a kind of two vows, in a sense, of how I was going to interrogate this material. One was that I was not going to have any references that read source X cited in source Y. I was always going to go back to the original text that was being referenced and to find out not just the individual passage that somebody else had thought was worth picking out, but what was the overall argument of that text, what was the context that it was framed in, and so on. So that sent me into a lot of different places to do on that. The second one was I was going to check everything back to the original language. That took a lot of time. There's a huge amount of the work that went into this book was of finding passages in the original in order to work out which particular words were being used to signify particular practices and concepts at a particular time. So there were two of the kind of guidelines of how I tried to do the work in this book. table of contents of the book kept getting bigger, and one of the tricky things with the project I found was to try to find a way to keep this under some kind of control without spiralling completely out of my ability to keep a handle on this, but to go into sufficient depth into the questions and so on. Now, I'm not going to try and talk about even very much of this. I'm just going to pick out four kind of elements that I think are important in the story and that relate back to some of the things that I was saying a moment ago. One of the things that's really interesting about the Middle Ages, and one of the surprises for me was how much of the book ended up being on the Middle Ages. That went from being a chapter to a couple of chapters to becoming over half of the book on that historical period. One of the things that was really interesting in that for me was that the lineage of Greek and Roman concepts into modern political thought is not a straightforward story. There's an awful lot of breaks in that story. There's an awful lot of things where texts would almost disappear from intellectual circulation for centuries, only to be picked up at a later time in a completely different context and reread for very, very different purposes. And one of the texts that's particularly important in this is Aristotle's political writings, not just the Politics, but also the Ethics and the Rhetoric. Aristotle's texts as a whole were translated into Latin in the late middle, in late antiquity, in the sort of dying days of the Roman Empire in the West. The political texts, though, weren't. And so because there were very, very few people who could read Greek in the Latin West, those texts fell out of circulation. They were not part of the intellectual currency that people were engaging with through a large part of the Middle Ages. When they did come back into circulation in the Latin West, it was actually through Arabic. There were Arabic translations of the Greek. There were Latin scholars who could read Arabic, and so they were reading these texts at another degree of distance from the original text. Now, when Aristotle's texts started coming to Latin, either through Arabic or then eventually directly from Greek into Latin, this changed the vocabulary by which people talked about political rule. Politics itself is a Greek-based word for one thing. It's a relatively rare word in a lot of the texts before that time in Latin. After about the 13th century, it starts to become a very common word in thinking about this. But these texts were important for people like Thomas Aquinas and then a slightly later generation of thinkers who were trying to work out what was the power that the king, particularly the king of France, had in relation to, on the one hand, the Pope, and on the other hand, the Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. And these were people that were trying to say, what power does the king have that is not already covered by the power that the Pope has? Or what power does the king have in his kingdom that is not something that the emperor might try to claim in an expansionist vision of the empire? So you get a whole range of writings, late 13th, early 14th century, trying to grapple with this question. What is the scope of temporal power? What is the scope of what we'd now call secular political theory as opposed to political theology? An important text in this is a book, a Latin book called The Question of Papal Power, an anonymous text, which makes the claim that France, and by that they mean the King of France, France has no superior in temporal authority, in regular kind of political sovereignty, we'd call it today, neither emperor nor pope. And then it makes the claim that is important in terms of a vocabulary and a spatial sense of this. The king in his kingdom, the Rex in Regno, and the emperor in the empire are effectively the same kind of territorial rulers, or the same kind of rulers, that the status of the emperor and the status of the king is such that they have no superior in this temporal matters. In matters of doctrine, sin, salvation, ecclesiastical matters, they'd still recognise the Pope as their superior. But in everyday political rule, they were the supreme authority within this area. But it's a very loose sense of what that area might be, in the kingdom or in the empire. Not a clearly demarcated territory as we might understand it today, but a much looser sense of an affiliation of political rule to a place over which it governs. And then you get a range of writers, beginning of the 14th century, grappling with this kind of question. How can we articulate what our power is in relation to the power that the emperor has? So John of Paris, writing on behalf of the French king, Dante, much better known as a poet, but also writing for a resurgent idea of an Italian empire within the Italian peninsula, Marsilius of Padua, writing on behalf of free cities within the Italian peninsula, and William of Ockham writing a defence of the vow of poverty of the Franciscans within the Catholic Church. Now, what Ockham is doing there is not simply saying that an individual devout person should be poor, and nor is he saying that the church should be poor in terms of not having wealth. He's also saying that the church should be poor in the world. The church should not involve itself in day-to-day political matters. And that defence that he makes in a number of his writings, his later political writings, is an articulation of what the Franciscans might have as a view of what the church should do, as opposed to the power of the papacy and the particular lines that they might have. The second kind of broken trajectory that I try to trace in the book is Roman law. This is the law of initially Rome as a republic, but particularly Rome as an empire, classical Rome. And this, again, fell out of circulation in the Latin West. The texts that we had in the 11th, 12th century, and they're still the ones that we have as the body of Roman law today, are actually a Byzantine codification of Roman law from the 6th, 7th century. They're not the original sources, but it's what a Byzantine emperor, Justinian, decided was the parts of the Roman law that were worth preserving. Now, these texts again fell out of circulation in the Latin West, but when they came back into circulation, you had a fully formed legal code in Latin that was written on the classical model that could be used and was adopted by a number of states in continental Europe as the basis for their legal system. Now, there's a whole set of textual questions that I won't go into here about these things, but one of the key questions that keeps coming up time and time again in commentaries on this, what is the extent of the law or the jurisdiction? In other words, where does the law apply and where does the law cease to apply? And the second one is, if there's a conflict between two different legal codes, how do you decide which one should apply in a particular instance? This is what we call today the conflict of the laws. Here's a particular example that comes up as an issue. And it's one, I think, that has parallels to what's been going on the last 10 years or so in terms of Iraq and in terms of contractors working on behalf of the US military in Iraq. But this is an example that Bartolus of Sassafrato in the 14th century comes up with. Suppose the army of one city is occupying the territorium of another, and one foreigner kills another there, may he be punished by the authorities of this city? You've got at least three, possibly four, depending on what the grammar is pointing to here, legal codes that could apply. The place where it happens, the law of the place that is now occupying that area, the legal code that the individual who commits the crime might have, and the legal code of the person who has the crime committed against them might have. Now, this question of which legal code applies is a question that Bartolus and many others of his time spend a lot of time thinking about and working through. But what Bartolus does in answering this question, in writing a legal opinion, is to clarify what he means by the notion of territory. Now, the first one is important, but I'm not going to say very much about it. He says that territorium is a res immobilis, an immovable thing. And this is because Roman law had two types, broadly, two types of law pertaining to property. Movable things and immovable things. Movable things would be most kinds of forms of property, individual goods, possessions, clothes, these kinds of things. Immovable things would largely be to do with agriculture, farmland, particular kinds of farm equipment, certain types of animals that might be used on farms. And there's two distinct branches of Roman law pertaining to property. That's interesting, it's important, it's the kind of economic angle here, but it's the one I think is less interesting compared to this one. Well, Thomas says, territorium is so-called from terrifying, and makes a reference now to the digest of Roman law. This is Justinian's digest of Roman law. So long as the army is there terrifying and dictating to that place, an offence there committed would properly be able to be punished by the authorities of the city as if it had been committed in their own territory. In other words, he's suggesting that occupation takes a legal code with it in terms of imposing that rule in a particular location. But it's this reference where he says territorium is linked to the idea of terrifying, of asserting a particular form of power, a particular form of scaring people away. And this terror and territory relation is something that many people have picked up, both etymologically but also in terms of political practice around those kind of questions. But that reference to the legal text, the digest, is worth looking at, I think. This is a text from Sextus Pomponius, who was a Roman lawyer writing at the time of Hadrian, the Emperor Hadrian, after the wall is named. And Pomponius in the second century says the territorium is the sum of the lands, or the aggregate of the lands, within the boundaries of a civitas, a city or a political community, which some say is so named because the magistrate of a place has within its boundaries the right of terrifying, that is, summoning or expelling. People who know Giorgio Agamben's work could see there's a kind of potential for making a reading along those lines to this. So there's a number of things that are going on in this. You've got a second century text codified in the 6th century, read in the 14th century, and as I'll suggest, goes on to have an important resonance in the 17th century in debates within Germany, but I think also shapes some of the ways that we think about these questions today. Now, Bartolus' most famous student, Bordas de Bordas, makes this kind of fairly pithy statement that is one that again gets picked up again and again. It's this relation of geographical area, the territorium, and political power. This is the thing that keeps coming up, but here explicitly legal power. Territory and jurisdiction, he says, go together like mist in a swamp. You can't have one without the other. These two things always are found intertwined with each other, and it's not able to privilege one, but these two things always go together in terms of how we think about those questions. Okay, so that's the second of them, the Roman law kind of heritage. I've talked a lot about texts, and the book does talk a lot about texts. This is the main kind of source material that I use. But not all of the texts are simply to do with writing. A lot of these texts were guidebooks for practice. Just a couple of examples of guidebooks for practice that I draw on in here. One is from a text that's usually known as the Corpus Sacramentorum Romanorum, the body of writings by the Roman land surveyors or the land measurers. And these were the people that were sent out to mark out the boundaries of farmers' fields within the Republic and within the Empire. And it's a set of kind of fairly crude systems of measuring in terms of individual property rights. But scaled up, these are ones that are very similar to how states would think about demarcating the boundaries of their territories. So this is an important text, and there's a whole set of complexities about whether this text actually relates to the time that it was written by Frontinus, or whether it's more that it's an imposition of vocabulary at the time that it was codified in the corpus and so on. So there's a whole set of questions there that I got quite tangled up in thinking through around that, particularly on the question of vocabulary. But the second example of a practical thing comes from Bartolus, who I mentioned a few moments ago. And this is a text that he wrote about rivers. And he was very interested in some property issues to do with rivers. If a river changes direction and washes some of the land on one side of the river onto the banks on the other side of the river, which farmer owns that land? The one whose side of the river it was on initially, or the one where the land washes up on the other side? Or if an island emerges within a river through accumulation of debris and so on, and this builds up and you end up with some solid land in the middle of a river, who owns that island? And the third question, if a river dries up, who owns the rights to the dried up riverbed? Now, those are questions that Justinian, the Byzantine emperor, had in his institutes or legal codes. And the time that they were writing and the time that even Bartolus is thinking about this is to do with individual farm owners. It's to do with land as a property kind of relation. But again, these are exactly the same kinds of issues that states struggle with today when boundaries between states are ones that either cross a river or use a river as part of the marking out of that boundary. So what Bartolus does in this text is not just the legal arguments, but he also does this fairly crude geometry to try to work out who should have which portion of this. This is 14th century geometry. It's before Descartes and modern coordinate analytic geometry. So it's a fairly crude way of trying to apportion. It's to do with relation and balance rather than to do with calculation in a pure sense. But it's a kind of founding text of what you might call legal geometry or even legal geography to try to work through in a practical set of questions how you might resolve these particular issues that he's struggling with. The last example that I want to talk about, which links back both to the first and the second examples about this question of the scope of temporal power and the importance of the Roman law, is in a set of debates that are going on in 17th century Germany. And my sense is that in terms of the questions that I was asking in this book, the standard people we read in the history of political thought of the 17th century are the wrong places to look. That we would standardly read people like Hobbes, maybe Filmer, certainly Locke. This doesn't seem to me to be the place where these debates are actually taking place in terms of this relation between territory and political power that I was interested in. And it's the Germans that are grappling with these kinds of issues at this time. And one of the reasons that they're grappling with this is they don't know how to make sense of the Holy Roman Empire. They don't know how to make sense of the power that the emperor has, but also the free cities, the principalities, the duchies, the kingdoms, all of the different constituent bits of the Holy Roman Empire. How do you apportion political authority between those places? So just a couple of examples of texts that I tried to work with to think through some of these questions here. One of them is from Johannes Althusius in a book called The Politica. And he makes a definition in the second sentence of this, where he's defining the idea of a territory. I identify the territory of a province as whatever is encompassed by the limits or the boundaries within which its laws are exercised. Now there's that, and there's another quotation in a moment, that if you found in a kind of traditional today, a contemporary political theory, political geography textbook, is the territory is whatever is within the boundaries where the law of a state or the sovereignty of a state is exercised. It's a fairly standard kind of definition. In the 17th century, I think that's actually quite a new definition. It's an emerging definition to think about it in that term and with that kind of vocabulary. Now, what he's trying to work out here is the power the emperor has in power of the individual rulers within the Holy Roman Empire. And what he tries to suggest is that, yes, you have the supreme magistrate. This is his name for the emperor, the Holy Roman Emperor. And this person has this kind of overarching superiority, or he sometimes calls it majesty. But the individual rulers have these rights that are rooted to their territories, that it's a geographically determined thing that sets out their rule, as opposed to the overarching power that the emperor has. And that he sets this out and he goes into an enormous amount of detail of working through these questions. But at the end of this, he says, such is the common judgment of jurists. Now, one of the things that Althusius does is he never fails to footnote something, which makes him extremely useful for somebody like me who's going back to this, because you can trace all of the texts that he found were useful in coming to this argument that he's making at this point. Some of them are these 14th century Roman lawyers, some of them are his contemporaries, and how he's drawing on particular texts around these kinds of questions. So he's making this argument here about a distinction between a territorial superiority and a majesty or a sort of supremacy that the emperor might have, a distinction that's based on, one is based in particular locations, the other is this looser, more sort of floating sense of political authority. And here's the second definition, which is, again, very similar to what political geographers have been thinking the question of territory is. What I'm trying to suggest in this book is actually a produced definition. It's not one that we've always had, but it's one that emerges through a complicated set of arguments and histories. Now, as well as those 14th century lawyers, he also mentions this book by Andreas Knicken. And at that point, instead of providing a book, chapter, verse type citation, he just says the whole thing. This book is the answer for Althusius to the kinds of questions that he's trying to grapple with. Now, what Knicken does in that book that's very important, I think, is he ties two distinct traditions of political thought together. One is the German tradition, the German word Landeshoheit, or landlordship, or land rule, a kind of a feudal system of property and land, and the hierarchical system that you had through much of the Middle Ages in terms of property and land gives you political power. And he ties this and says that these two terms are effectively synonymous to a Latin tradition of territorial superiority. And in pulling those two traditions together, what he's arguing is that you can actually bolster both by supporting them by the other, that you can bring these otherwise distinct bodies of thought together to think through these kinds of questions. And he makes a very clear distinction between majesty that the emperor has, this superarching kind of overall type of authority, and what he calls the multiple territorial rights or territorial laws that the individual princes or parts of the empire have in relation to it. So territory, as tied to political rule or to legal rule, is something that is multiple. There are many territories, and within each of those territories there is a particular legal code that pertains in those instances. The third of the 17th century writers that I just want to briefly mention as I come to a close with these comments. I'm not going to say who this is just for a moment. What he says is that he's talking about an argument about what are the rights that the Duke of Hanover has after the Treaties of Westphalia. The Treaties of Westphalia have brought to an end the 30 Years' War, religious wars within Europe. They've supposedly settled things within Europe, but also as a constitution for the Holy Roman Empire. And the Duke of Hanover says, I don't really know what power I have. Can you please clarify this for me? So this is a political theorist working on behalf of a political ruler. Now, he goes around this in a very, very long-winded way. He ends up writing a text that was supposed to be a briefing document that became several hundred pages, and so he was forced to abandon that and then try and write a shorter, distilled version of the argument. One is in Latin, one is in French. It gets quite complicated in terms of the vocabulary, but he makes in the end, when he finally gets to it, a very succinct argument that I found very useful in this. Now, what he does here is he says, hence there arises what the German jurists call territorial superiority. Now, he uses a Latin phrase here, but he clearly means this German phrase of Landeshoheit. You can tell this from his other writings on this topic. Or the high right of territory, the exact same phrase that Andreas Knecken uses. But he says the Italians preceded them, and Baldus, the 14th century lawyer I mentioned before, used to say that superiority inheres in territory like mist to a swamp. And yet Baldus didn't say superiority inheres in territory, Baldus said jurisdiction inheres in territory. So what this writer is doing is shifting a legal argument into a more explicitly political argument in that shift of vocabulary, of adopting the language that somebody like Knecken was using. And then he talks about particular kinds of power that sit in relation to that. This right, in turn, he says, belongs not only to the princes of the empire, but also to the counts. For a long time, there was doubt concerning the free cities, but recently, especially by the Peace of Munster, the question seems to have been settled. And what we call territorial superiority, i.e. we Germans, i.e. Landeshoheit, seems to be identical to what the French call souveraineté in a slightly looser sense. Now, I read this initially in English, where Pace in Primis Monasteriae was translated as the monastic peace, which made absolutely no sense to me whatsoever, until I checked back and found out what it actually said, and I thought, oh, that means the Peace of Munster. In other words, one of the two treaties of Westphalia. And then suddenly a lot of things started to make sense in terms of what the argument was that was being made at that particular point. Now, this writer is extremely well known, but he's not well known as a political theorist. He wrote this under a pseudonym, but it's actually Gottfried Leibniz, much better known as a philosopher, as a mathematician, but actually made most of his living working for the Hanover royal family, writing the history of the family, writing legal texts, helping the case for George III to become the King of England, these kind of day-to-day political advice questions. And what he's trying to do in this is to advise in terms of what the Duke of Hanover was going to do when he went to the peace treaty negotiations in 1677-78 in the Dutch town of Nijmegen. And the Peace of Nijmegen, where he writes these briefing documents for this, has commemorated the signing of the treaties of Nijmegen in this painting, which is very clearly, I think, modelled on a much more famous painting of the signing of the Treaty of Munster, part of the Treaties of Westphalia from 20 years before. And Nijmegen has realised this kind of heritage in European history and European thought. The museum now has original manuscript copies of the signings of the treaties. But Leibniz, I think, was a very important thinker in working through those kinds of questions. And he talks about this because he's explicitly tying political power to territory. And he's doing that in a very explicit way, in a way that I don't think is common before that in the political theory tradition. So he's talking about this at the very end of this definition. So territory signifies the whole of the laws and rights which come to obtain an inhabited portion of the earth, or when he's really forced by the Duke of Hanover to, you know, get to the point and tell us what you really mean, he says, the emperor, well, he has majesty. You are a sovereign, and to be a sovereign is to be master of a territory. And really, in Leibniz, I found the crystallization of a lot of different strands of thinking around these questions. It's not that Leibniz is a completely original thinker. I think Leibniz is really the culmination of a lot of different ways of thinking about these questions, and he pulls them together, and that in Leibniz I think we've got a recognisably modern way of thinking about this relation between political power and location, or what in the book I try to trace as the emergence of this question of territory. Thank you.